The Guardian.
This week on The Guardian Audio Edition, Luke Harding reports from Mali as the French army retake territory from jihadist forces. Peter Bradshaw gives 5 stars to Steven Spielberg's film, Lincoln. And in this week's audiobook review, we discover the world of Jane Austen's most beloved character, Elizabeth Bennet. To subscribe for free, go to audible.co.uk/guardianaudio or find us on SoundCloud, Audioboo and in iTunes. The Guardian Audio Edition, a new way to get the whole picture.
Hello, this is Politics Weekly. I'm Hugh Muir. As a triple-dip recession looms for the government, a sudden burst of activity. A new high-speed rail route unveiled. Childcare costs to be slashed. Powers to be wrestled back from Europe. And as the polls narrow once more, ideas of how the Tories might better appeal to black and minority voters. But with constituency boundary reform heading for oblivion, are David Cameron's hopes of re-election in 2015 moving in the same direction? And what about that Tory stalking horse? We'll give you our best tip. Joining me to discuss all this, those who study the political form, The Guardian columnist Martin Kettle, The Observer's economics editor Heather Stewart, and number 10 advisor, and who knows, a future MP, Sean Bailey. Welcome to all of you. Well, a busy week, as I say, and let's start with childcare, because the cost of childcare in Britain is amongst the highest in Europe. Parents are said to be paying close to a quarter of their income to their childminders. And it's an issue that some in the Treasury believe is holding back Britain's economic recovery. There's a simple logic there. If childcare costs are high, it makes less sense for some parents to go out to work. And the solution posed by one Tory minister this week, simply let nurseries and childminders look after more children. Heather, as an economist and as a mother, does this policy make sense to you?
It strikes me as a classic kind of economically liberal approach, you know, deregulating and hoping that the market will do the work. And actually, in this case, firstly, a lot of these people are working extremely hard already. They're very badly paid. So, do you know what? If they're looking after more kids, it should mean a pay rise for them. They're very low paid workers in doing a tough, tough job and a very important one. Secondly, a lot of nursery companies are running on wafer thin margins. So although there is competition, you might see, you know, the extra benefits of looking after more kids swallowed up in their margins, their profit margins, rather than flowing back to parents. And thirdly, I'd be extremely concerned about the quality of care if you know, you're chucking another baby in and, you know, with the same number of workers. And I know the argument is that continental countries have more lax rules on how many children can be looked after at the same time, but you know, in many cases they often have much better funded and more consistent systems. So I think that the most likely outcome of this is that we all get worse care and probably don't pay very much less for it.
But doesn't it benefit everyone to get more kids into that system, so more parents can go out to work, and so the nurseries themselves can make more income?
It's a good thing to get more women into work, absolutely. And I'm afraid to say I pay more than a quarter of my income in childcare, so that sounds very familiar. But I'm concerned about the idea that the answer to that problem is to drive down the pay of childminders. That doesn't seem to me to be a particularly helpful solution. And you know, it's a good thing to get more kids into care, but not if it's poor quality care that isn't benefiting them, you know, where they're going to be parked in front of the telly all week.
Sean Bailey, the government seems to be slightly backing away from these proposals. There was the spectacle of one minister, I think it was Claire Perry, suggesting that maybe Liz Truss, the early years minister, had got a bit ahead of herself over the funding. Do you think the government have been a bit put off by the reaction to this?
I don't know where the government are on this, but I will say this. The ratios of childcare, carers to children, are slightly arbitrary. Where did they come from? I used to be a youth worker and we had a very similar system, and you'd cross these magic boundaries. So once a child was over 6, apparently they didn't need as much care as they did the day before they were 6, and that kind of stuff. And I think all of that's very important, because the bottom line is, as a parent, as a married parent, my wife is painful, feels very badly about being trapped at home. And I use that word trapped at home with our children. If nurseries can find a way for a change in the law to accommodate more children, I actually think that would be a very, very powerful change to the texture of the British workforce and to many people's homes. I personally think it's doable. I really think it probably should be done, because what would would alert me if it shouldn't be done is if nurseries really complained. If they really kick up a stink, then there's something to say because they're the professionals in the arena.
Well, a lot of them are very unhappy about
this. The childcare trusts are certainly, the daycare trusts, I think they're called, aren't they? Yeah, certainly, a lot of childminders are very unhappy about it.
The National Childminders Association, the Daycare Trust, the National Day Nurseries Association.
Because they don't feel they can do more for less.
Well, if that's the case, then it needs to be looked at. Could be why people are now changing their minds. But I suppose a change in the law doesn't mean you have to act on it as a nursery, I suppose. That would be my thing. You could say to me, I can have 10 children and I can tell my client base I'm just going to continue to have 6. I'm not particularly concerned about what the law says because I'm on the right side of the law, as it were. But I do really think we need to do something about the cost of childcare because it has significantly changed the look of family life in Britain. It's very, very tough a subject.
Martin, politically, is this a dangerous area to be tinkering with?
It's a dangerous area for two reasons, I think. First of all, because it's a key issue for women, and women are a very large group of voters who the Tories struggle to appeal to.
They're 16 points behind, I think, on women.
Yes, and the second thing, I think, is that it goes very much to the question of whether life's getting better or worse under the coalition. And I think it's quite difficult to square these proposals with the narrative that we are getting more for less and things are kind of gradually getting better, because clearly it's a squeeze and so on. I mean, it's a long time since my children were young enough to have childcare. They're well grown up now. But my impression is that, you know, actually there is quite a lot of regulation in the childcare field, which is probably worth looking at afresh in a non-partisan way.
Absolutely.
Because I think, I think as we saw this week in the Court of Appeal ruling on criminal records, there was a bit of a blunderbuss approach taken to do with working with children. And it may be that there are, at the margins, there are some ways of cutting back on that. You go to other European countries and, you know, as Heather says, I mean, the provision is better, but they also have a lot more assistance as well as actually qualified childminders. So, there's actually other pairs of hands. And in childminding, as I do remember, what you need is several
pairs of hands. Yeah.
Talk about the economics of it, though. Is there a prize to be gained here for the government? Are they right in that?
Yes, because there's IPPR research quite recently which suggested that even if you completely subsidised, you know, even if you paid for childcare for the youngest children, you would get more back from the revenue in mums going back to work. You'd get more back in income tax than you would in you know, not paying for it as a government and you know, the mums staying at home. I just one of my anxieties about this is that, I mean, Sean's right, the nurseries will, and childcare providers will be able to say, do you know what, I don't want to do this because I don't think I can provide care of the quality that I want to. It, you know, it's up to the market to decide. But then more affluent mums will be able to say, great, I'm going to choose a childminder, you know, who can provide that better quality care. And mums on very low wages won't be able to make that choice. They'll just have to go for the cheapest option. And you know, if it's a free-for-all, that option may not be a very good...
But I'd say that already exists.
Absolutely. Yeah,
one nursery
true.
Looks
yeah.
very different to the other.
Yeah.
And the bottom line is, to pick up your point about, would you know, is the coalition making life better? Let me make this quite clear to you. If you reduced our childcare costs by £10 a week, that would make our life significantly better.
No, that's absolutely
better.
True.
So when you say to people, you know, a raise in numbers, should we be tinkering? This is one of the, you know, there's a number of things that would make a difference in someone's day-to-day life. And I'd argue that this is in the top three. It is debilitating socially, emotionally, to know that a large part of your income is going that way. And if someone said to you, we're going to reduce that, that'd be great. And it's going to sound strange, but I could imagine moving that £10 into our food bill. I mean, you know, I really do think that if you could lower the cost, particularly because it comes out of your after-tax income, it'd be massively important.
So you spend a lot of time in Downing Street. So when Dave comes up to you and says, Sean, I've got this great idea, this great policy, but it looks like it's running into the sand. What do I do with it? What would you tell him?
Fortunately for me, two things. I've now moved to the Cabinet Office.
But he'll ring you on that hotline and he'll say, save my policy.
Secondly, this is my area. But as a parent, I would say, hold on, because a variety in the market, because you know, the real question is, why is child provision so expensive? Everybody's talked about how in different countries they have more subsidies, etc., but it isn't as expensive. What is going on? And the first place you look is at the regulations. There's something that makes our childcare hideous. hideously expensive. And anybody, government or otherwise, who's looking to refine that, remove some of that cost, parents countrywide would welcome that.
Okay, let's move on. Heather, as we mentioned at the top, the context to all of this is a potentially triple dip recession if we have another quarter of negative growth. Is the government showing signs of desperation? Because they set a lot of store by their economic competence and economic management, and things don't seem to be going as they would hope.
Well, I wouldn't say desperate is the word. They're just determined to stick with the same old tune. I mean, I saw George Osborne, being wheeled out in Davos last week to explain, what he thought was going to happen. This was the night before the GDP figures were released, and he trotted out this very tired tale that it's a long road, it's a bumpy road, and the economy is healing, and these sort of stock phrases that you now hear every time you ring the Treasury press office. I mean, I think they're anxious, but I don't get the sense that they're drawing up some, top secret plan B. I mean, I think they're just still crossing their fingers and hoping. The real risk that we face, I think, is that we do see another negative quarter of growth. And even if we don't, the credit ratings agencies have sent a strong signal that they're considering stripping us of our AAA rating, which for George Osborne is a kind of badge of honour. He's told us to use that as a measure of whether his policies are succeeding. And actually, our safe haven status, which has led investors to keep lending us money, despite, the fact the economy doesn't seem to be recovering, that could be under threat from the fact that the Eurozone crisis now has gone very quiet. So there's a lot less to take us, to need a safe haven from, as it were. And I'm quite nervous that the UK is going to suffer as a result.
Martin, how politically toxic is that phrase, triple dip?
I think it's probably not quite as toxic as we might be tempted to think it is. It's not good. It's not something they're looking forward to if it happens. But I think the big question politically really is still, in British politics, are we living in a things are hard but Labour will make it better world, or are we living in a things are hard but Labour will make it worse world? And I don't think anybody really quite knows the answer to that. Triple dip, recession, loss of AAA status, none of these things helps. All of those things push the argument towards Labour, but there's a long way to go, I think. And, I think basically the voters do accept it's a long road, do accept it's a bumpy road, have got used to the fact that we're in a different kind of recession and a different kind of economic situation, which is not going to be magicked into conventional, as we have previously seen them, levels of growth in the next year or two. It is going to go on for quite a long time, and politics is going to have to adjust to that. In some ways,
right.
I think the Conservatives are quite well ahead of the game on that by comparison with Labour. You're still waiting to hear the kind of, it's the cliche of the time, the Labour narrative of where the economy is actually going and what they would do about it. So I think it's still very fragile, very contingent.
You said Conservatives ahead of the game, words that make Sean Bailey smile. But let's leave that for now. And you can find plenty more on that subject on guardian.co.uk/politics. Now, here's an idea. FTSE-listed companies should make public the racial composition of their workforces. So says Conservative backbencher Alok Sharma, and he's urging Number 10 to act. Number 10 doesn't seem quite so keen on the idea from, the Tory vice chairman, because they see it as something that might present more bureaucracy. But Sean, you've got the Prime Minister's ear. What are you telling him that he should be doing?
I mean, as a member of the black community, that laboured hackneyed term, I would say this, it probably wouldn't make much difference, because what would happen is, if you release the ratios and you run a massive multinational company and all your cleaners are black, you will look like you have a diverse workforce. Where diversity is where people are along your hierarchical line. And on top of that, it then comes about what happens next. It's easy. If you have a quota, you fill your quota, you send out your press release, and there you are. But what have you actually done about keeping that going? And then that's a thin end of the wedge. Do you then do that for women, for disabled people, for elderly people? It is a thin end of the wedge. And it reminds me of the Football Manager argument, where they said, a black candidate should always be interviewed. But that's fine. I'll interview you. Tick my box doesn't mean you're going to get the job. It's where people are in my hierarchy, and can that stream continue?
But of course, we know there's a context of that specific idea. The wider notion, I think flagged up by the Times this week, that the Tories really have to win more minority votes if they're to achieve a majority. you're there at the nerve centre. What generally is being done to crack that particular nut?
First thing, these two things are absolutely divorced. As a black man sitting in my house, if the government changed the law to make you express how many black people work for you, this will do nothing for my voting pattern. My voting pattern is determined by you, what you look like, what you say to me, what your history is, and how you're going to change the future of your organisation. So changes in the law in that fashion are completely and utterly separate. Your average black man in the street probably wouldn't even notice that and relate it to where he's going to vote next.
But what can you do?
For me, it's about representation. It's what I call wedding photo politics. If you go to a wedding, someone takes a photo and they share the photo, the first thing you do is look for yourself, then you look for the bride. If you can't see yourself in the makeup of the Tory wedding photo, then the Tories have a problem. And it goes deeper. So I need to see myself in that wedding photo and understand how that person got there. And I need to believe that it's possible for me and my children to get there as well. Because if not, it's tokenism, and that will have the exact reverse effect. My affections for you will be damage irreparably if I think you're using me as a token. That's the way in which you get people in. It's a long-term investment in a group, and that group can be any group, you know, gay people, poor people, black people. It's a long-term investment, me seeing myself in your wedding photo.
It's tough though, isn't it? Because people have very preconceived ideas about the Conservative Party that you really struggle to deal with. I think Alok Sharma was quoted this week saying, we still have the baggage of what Enoch Powell said all those years ago in terms of rivers of blood. And people saying, well, I'm not going to vote Tory if I'm a minority because that's the sort of view that gets expressed. Now, that was a long time ago. So how do you even start overcoming that?
You take it on. I suggest he's right. One of the things that I think the left and Labour have been particularly effective in is doing the Tory party's PR around, you know, racial issues. I think they've been brilliant at that. And, you know, it's a fight. Politics is a fight. You can't fault them for that. But the Tories have to take it on head on every level, because as a black man who's been involved in Tory politics, when you arrive, it's refreshingly different to what you think you're going to be dealing with. But that's all internal. That's a secret. Nobody cares. That fight needs to be taken public. The likes of Francis Maud, Ian Duncan Smith, some of the Tory donors who feel differently about these things, and also the PM need to be seen regularly. This is the point, regularly. It has to be a story, not an event. Regularly challenging these views and taking them on. And then people have to look and see, well, the top end of the party talks like that. How does the bottom end? What happens when I walk into an association meeting room? How am I greeted? Because that's how people really judge the world. And if the top starts talking that we need to be open, and open for the right reason, not through guilt, not through, you know, this sort of PC wanting to appeal, but through the understanding that diversity brings strength. That's the reason to open up the Tory party to everybody.
Martin, if the appeal to more minority votes is part of a wider strategy, perhaps we should see it in the context of, for this week's big parliamentary news, the boundary reform fiasco. If it's going to get tight in 2015, the Tories are surely going to need every single vote they can get, aren't they?
Absolutely. I mean, this is a minority Tory government, you know, elected on about 36% of the vote in 2010. That's basically not enough to win a general election, however you cut it, for any party. And so, you know, the Tories need more votes, not fewer votes. And they, at the moment, their vote is down. They're also very geographically hemmed in some respects. And so, you know, socially and geographically, the Tory party is in danger of being just an English party and predominantly a Southern and Midlands English party. And I think that's a profound problem for them because, you know, they do have some strength in the north. They do have some strength in Wales. They have a little bit in Scotland. I mean, they're not capturing seats with anything like regularity at local level, without anything like the regularity to suggest that they're going to win many more extra seats outside of the core English areas where they continue to do that. So, therefore, London becomes extremely important, and the whole Boris Johnson factor, I think, plays very importantly in the 2015 election, because London is one of the areas where the Tories need to hold seats, and you know, as Sean knows only too well, needs to win seats as well. And that's also true in other parts of the kind of semi-urban south. So, you know, these areas matter a great deal to the Tories, because without them, it's just a repetition of 2010 and all the sort of existential agonies which the Tory party is going through about the fact that it wishes it could have a majority but doesn't have one.
What actually happened in the Commons is that the Lib Dems have been taking quite a lot of fire. I think Quentin Letts wrote in the Daily Mail about the boundary vote. I've never felt such disgust for our political class. I mean, this may be a slightly overblown, but was it just skullduggery from the Lib Dems, or did they have a point in taking the... they have justification in taking the route they took?
Well, there is I could sit here and make a po-faced straight argument on this, but I mean, you know, the wonderful thing about politics is that self-interest always trumps principle, and you know, that's one of the glories of politics, not one of the not one of its shames, in my opinion. And you know, this is a classic example. The reason the Lib Dems voted against the boundary changes is because it's not in their interest to change the boundaries. Full stop. They're going to have a hard enough time on. Even under the existing boundaries, but it would have been a lot worse under the new ones. So, you know, self-interest, it's a great motivator.
Sean, self-interest, are you shaking your fist at the Lib Dem coalition partners?
I am, because I feel sorry for the British public, because the bottom line is that the boundary review needs to be done technically. The disparity in the sizes of the seats is incredible. The smallest seats are less than half the biggest seats in numbers of voters, and that's just not correct. It distorts, you know, the power of one vote and what the whole, you know, democratic project's about. So I actually think it would be good to get it done from that point of view. I mean the bill says it will come back in 2017, I believe. At some point it will have to be dealt with, but I think it's anti-democratic not to deal with it. But let's be frank, if you're a Lib Dem, you know, you could see technically how this could work out for you, and I imagine you'd have to be a very upright character to vote yourself into oblivion. Turkey's voting for Christmas and all the rest of that.
But they all are upright in the Commons. That's why they're there.
I'm sure they all are. But, you know, I had a slightly different view from where I was stood. But there you go.
Martin?
I mean, I think there is... Sean's right. You know, it's unacceptable that constituencies have the disparities that they have. The system should be changed. There should be reform. The problem is that everything is connected with everything else. And even in the area of electoral reform and political reform, I'm sure you don't want me to get into a long spiel about that right now, but you know, the question of what size a constituency ought to be, you know, is quite a serious question. And the trouble was that they put this boundary, they gave the Boundary Commission too tight a mandate. They basically said everything has to be within 5% of the mean. Every constituency has to be within 5% of the mean. And the consequences of that were just a bit too disruptive. It meant that almost every seat, bar about 60, was changed. That's not great for another aspect of parliamentary government, which is the sense of the constituency MP relationship. Yeah. And, you know, it could have been done better. And hopefully in the future it will, but it'll have to be connected to a lot of other changes in other areas too, including the House of Lords.
Heather Stewart, just quickly, if they fall out over things like this, the Tories and the Lib Dems, will that damage their main priority, which is the economy and sorting out the economy?
Well, I mean, I think the odd relationship between Vince Cable and George Osborne, which is, you know, less than a loving, I think it's fair to say, doesn't particularly help economic policy. And I think it, you know, it makes it difficult to drive a coherent policy through. But no, I think that the Lib Dems are just as sort of nailed to the mast of deficit reduction as are the Tories. So I don't think we're going to see a kind of sudden schism on that element of policy, at least.
Well, Martin, as we know, when the numbers get tight, MPs get nervous. And as night follows day, there was talk this week of a stalking horse ready to challenge David Cameron. The man ID'd as the potential replacement was the MP for Windsor, Adam Afrir. What was your take on all that?
I think there's no smoke without fire. And I think that's, you know, that's a pretty iron rule. Whatever is
in
happening...
In life as well as in politics, yeah.
Something's happening. It may not be quite the story that's come out, and it may not be quite as important and exciting as it obviously seemed, you know, when it was in the papers at the weekend. All that said, Cameron's not a very popular leader with his party. He's not loved. He's done some things which are, I think, counterproductive in terms of, you know, hanging on to his support in the party. I happen to think he's by far the best leader the Tory party could possibly have at the moment, and they're mad to try and get rid of him. It's really seriously dangerous. But the fact is that there are two or three groups of within the party. There's the Eurosceptic, really hard Eurosceptic right. There's the disaffected, you know, the people who think they should be in the government and aren't, and so on. And then there's the ones who simply cannot forgive Cameron, I think, for, you know, the changes that he's made in the party. So, you know, I think there are lots of, you know, I think there's a lot of disaffection there. He's not a great party manager. There is this sense always of it being a fairly elite operation, you know, well caricatured, obviously, by Labour, you know, as posh boys and all of that. And of course, Nadine Dorries too. But, you know, there's a constituency for a new leader. Who that new leader would be is a completely different matter. And I think, you know, the rules don't really allow a stalking horse anyway, which nobody has actually pointed out very much.
Sean, I didn't see your name anywhere in dispatches in all of this, but we did, of course, learn of the creation of a new set. We've had the Chipping Norton set, now we've got the Windsor set, which is supposed to be Adam Frere's mob. Which would you prefer to be taking your supper with?
I'm one of the clever Tories who just wants to keep out of the whole thing.
Very wise.
I mean, I think the PM, I think the Europe thing, I and everybody else was quite happy about what he said about Europe, and I think that's sort of pushed him back up as the only one. I think the thing about this stalking horse or not, Adam Frere or not, you know, Chipping Norton set, Windsor set, I think what happened with the Europe speech, most of factions of the party were very satisfied, and that again elevated David as the leader. I am the leader. You may have used different tactics if you were the leader, but I'm the leader, and here's why I'm the leader. And by giving that, you know, very substantial speech, I bumped into a few MPs of differing shades and was quite surprised at everybody's sort of collective, yeah, that was the right thing to do. So I don't think he has anything to worry about right just now. And I mean, it's politics. People are always talking about, you know, should we have a different leader, this, that, and the other, and everyone thinks they should be the leader. So I think it's not the big story that the press would have liked it to have been. You know, the cycle of politics means it will come back, but this time round, I don't think so.
Well, the media loves a plot, and the Commons loves a plot, and it does love a cleverly worded question too. And Alex Cunningham, the Labour MP for Stockton North, brought his best shot into the Commons and fired it at the Prime Minister.
On the subject of food safety, can the Prime Minister confirm that traces of stalking horse have been found in the Conservative Party food chain?
My briefing, I had some very complicated information about the danger of particular drugs for horses entering the food chain, and I have to say he threw me completely with that ingenious pivot. I think what I would say is the Conservative Party has always stood for people who want to work hard and get on, and I'm glad that all of those behind me take that very seriously indeed.
Cameron was good, I thought. You know, I mean, if anybody watched Prime Minister's questions, they'd probably be rather impressed with the relaxed way in which he handled it. He took it as a joke and had a little dig at Adam Frere too. That's all good stuff. Whether any of it counts outside Westminster, you know, cleverer people than me will spend a lot of time trying to work out. Well, that, I suspect it doesn't.
That line will be in pub quizzes for some time to come. And there's fascinating stuff in some of the blogs, one in particular by Peter Oborne in The Telegraph and another by Raphael Baer in The New Statesman, suggesting that perhaps Tory HQ itself leaked news of the plot. I think the idea being that they wanted to capitalise on Cameron's new authority after that Europe speech to squash the internal rumblings. Sean, is that Machiavellian, or does that sound as if it's got a ring of truth to it?
It sounds slightly Machiavellian to me, because you wouldn't... It's like lighting a fire just to burn a little bit of the forest. You know, you could lose control of that fire, couldn't you? So I don't know. My view, CCHQ, is that they wouldn't see the need to take the risk. I don't know. I personally, again, my controlling the fire metaphor, I just feel like there's a good way to get burnt.
Well, Machiavellian is a compliment in my in my lexicon. So, you know, if they did that, then good on them. Good play.
So was it Machiavellian or not, we shall see. But that's all we have time for this week. My thanks to Martin Kettle, Heather Stewart and Sean Bailey. I'm Hugh Muir, the producer of Politics Weekly was Phil Maynard. Thank you for listening and bye-bye.
This week on the Guardian Audio Edition, Luke Harding reports from Mali as the French army retake territory from jihadist forces. Peter Bradshaw gives 5 stars to Steven Spielberg's film Lincoln. And in this week's audiobook review, we discover the world of Jane Austen's most beloved character, Elizabeth Bennet. To subscribe for free, go to audible.co.uk/guardianaudio or find us on SoundCloud, Audioboo and in iTunes. The Guardian Audio Edition, a new way to get the whole picture.
For more great downloads, go to guardian.co.uk/audio.